Hello, welcome to today's show. Recently, Ben and I had a fascinating discussion with a guest, Simon from the Little Storping in the Swuff blog. Simon's in the UK, and he joined us via Skype to record a podcast. As with any conversation that you might have with interesting people on a topic that you find interesting, it tended to run a little longer than we would normally like. To be fair, it ran a lot longer than we would normally like. So I have broken it up into the next five pieces. Would that that were the only problem with this, and I wouldn't have bothered to tell you that. But there's also another issue. As you may have observed, the podcast has suffered from inconsistent audio. This is largely because, so far, with each new episode, we've been trying a different audio configuration. And it seems like with each new configuration, we solve one problem and we get a new one. In these upcoming episodes, you're going to find that you might think Darth Vader is somewhere in the room. In fact, this is a problem with my microphone picking up too much of my breathing and me having a bit of a sinus condition due to allergies. I've done everything I can to try to minimize the noise and punch up the other people in the conversation, but it's not perfect. Nonetheless, it seemed like too interesting of a conversation to just discard. I hope you'll bear with us. We will be working to correct this issue after this block. And now, on to the show! You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Tonight we are rounding out our Doctor Who coverage for the 2010 series with a special guest. We've got Simon joining me here with Ben tonight. Hey. Hello, Ben, you there too?
I'm here.
Great. And a little bit of background. A few years ago when David Tennant was first the Doctor, I ran across a blog, Little Storping in the Swuff, which is a blog out of the United Kingdom, which is Simon's blog, and we'll give you the links to that at the in the show notes, and maybe at the end if Simon will read it out, because I don't have it right in front of me. And Simon had done it, was doing an interesting comparison. Rather than saying, you know, the Doctor, this Doctor's better than that Doctor, what he had done is notice that there's a pattern formed, particularly in the first 2 years of Doctor Who, of the new Doctor Who, in that there's almost like the same type of episode from one season to the next. And so he grouped the episodes that way to compare how the Doctors and the stories went. And I thought that was a very interesting comparison system for using on Doctor Who. And that pattern has been shifted a little bit over the years, but it still holds pretty true. And so we thought, who better than to bring into the show and talk about these different categories and give us an opportunity to debate the relative merits of the last three Doctors. So, you guys ready? We'll just plow right into it. All right. So, Simon's article has categories for basically every type of story, but for the sake of time and our own sanity in preparation, we have picked out four of them, I believe. And so I will let Simon describe the category and what episodes, and then we will start from there. The first category is The New Guy.
Okay, so this is the episode in each season which introduces often the new companion, but on occasion the newly generated Doctor. So this was Rose introducing Rose in the first of the new series. Then there was The Christmas Invasion, which introduced the Tenth Doctor, as played by David Tennant. There was Smith and Jones, which introduced Martha Jones. Partners in Crime, which introduced, or rather reintroduced, Donna Noble. And then The Eleventh Hour, which introduced both the Eleventh Doctor, as played by Matt Smith, and Amy Pond. So, kicking off with Rose, this obviously was the first new series episode and, as it were, defined the show. And it did so by reviving an old enemy and taking the viewpoint, which is one of the things that I really like about these episodes, taking the viewpoint of the companion and letting us see the Doctor through the companion's eyes. Most of the time we're following the Doctor around and seeing what he sees. So it's quite an interesting take to step back from that, particularly introducing a new generation to the Doctor, and to see the Doctor as it were, an alien.
I think they did more. There was a lot of introductory text there, and I thought, in particular, at one point, Christer Eccleston is talking to Rose and trying to explain what he is. Has his little speech about you can feel the Earth moving and through space and turning under your feet, and I thought that was a very eerie and appropriate kind of mysterious description, and Rose captured that very well in kind of the look on her face and the feeling and the ambient music. And I thought that was a brilliant moment in that episode. But it was the Rose show. I mean, not just because of its name. That episode really focused on Rose more than anything else, for good or for bad, as the case may be. Ben, what do you think about it?
Well, I tend to actually agree with everything you just said, and I'm finding this awfully terrifying that you and I are agreeing on way too many things these days. I remember the first time I saw Rose, I remember just being partially mortified by what I was witnessing. But again, I'm coming from the standpoint of someone who has watched Doctor Who for an intensely long time, so I had to keep thinking, all right, this is Russell, this is RTD, who is writing for a brand new generation. That's something you have to keep telling me, Eugene. I have a hard time getting past that.
And we didn't know RTD either. I mean, I didn't.
I was only familiar with him from Queer as Folk, and knowing that he was a big Doctor Who fan. That's the extent of it. But I had to keep being reminded, this is for a brand new generation, because a lot of the people who are going to be watching this probably never saw Doctor Who. I mean, the question then becomes, and maybe Simon, you can shed some light on this, were the classic episodes still being aired in some form of syndication, or were they being repeated on any of the channels in the UK?
The satellite channel UK Gold was broadcasting classic episodes a lot, but the main channels, like the BBC channels on which it was originally broadcast, virtually never broadcast Doctor Who. It was one of the things they never repeated, and I thought it was very odd.
That's not uncommon, though, right? The BBC doesn't do a lot of repeats.
Well, they get hammered for it. they repeat certain programmes an awful lot, but they don't tend to go further back with some of their repeats, so they don't tend to report. They've got a massive archive of really high quality programs. They tend not to dip into it.
That's better for DVD sales, right?
Well, I guess so, but for many years there were no DVDs.
I would have expected that, given Doctor Who's amazing popularity. At one time, at least we here in the States honestly thought that, from what we were hearing, is that Doctor Who was insanely popular in the UK. And with that kind of history, you thought that some channel, I mean, some of the more mainstream BBC channels might still carry it. But it does answer to my point, and that is a lot of the people that would be watching television today probably never saw Doctor Who. It's, you know, because Russell was writing for a very young generation. I mean, it's really apparent, especially in the opening of the episode, Rose. I mean, at one point I thought I was watching, it was like a cross between Buffy the Vampire and something off MTV.
There's something to that. You know, and there's a couple cultural things in that episode that don't necessarily come across. I am familiar with the term council flats, but it's not really something that we have, in at least not in this part of the country in the United States. So it wasn't plainly obvious to me that Rose was essentially the equivalent of our trailer trash teenager. I didn't get that when I was watching that episode. It wasn't kind of until you'd start getting the back chatter to realize that this is sort of a disadvantaged poor people kind of environment that she was in, which, you know, makes Rose more interesting from a writing standpoint, because that's a classic story idea where you take somebody who is rising above her background and her family and her environs and doing something extraordinary. But I didn't get that out of the film. I just thought, yeah, she's just another person who lives in London and teenager and went on. But you say it was definitely an interesting to put that from the perspective of Rose. And I think it was appropriate in this episode that Rose is the person who saved the day.
There's a great line that picks up on that where they're just on the point of defeating the Nestine consciousness, and Rose says something to the effect of not having got any A-levels, but she's good at gym. Swings over and knocks the Autons holding the phial of whatever it is, the antiplast.
You know, O-levels and A-levels is something that doesn't translate to the American audience. I know it's a grading system, but I
know what they are. I wonder how many of our viewers know what they are, though.
Yeah, well, I know O-levels and A-levels are different grade school levels in going, but I can never keep them straight. Is an O-level higher than an A-level?
Well, to this generation of Doctor Who fans that we're talking about, an O-level probably won't mean anything either, because they went out about 20 years ago.
Really? Well,
you pick that they're there in the old TV episodes of the era, but GCSEs are the equivalent now. So you take a GCSE when you're 16, and then you'll take your A-levels 2 years later when you're 18 before you go on to university.
So an A-level is basically a level you get for college entrance kind of thing. So it's pre-college, but it's okay. So
everyone will do GCSEs. Some people go on to do A-levels, and then some people go on to do a degree.
So an A-level equates roughly to us graduating high school.
Yeah, and Rose had obviously dropped out for doing A-levels, and hence working in Hendricks and not getting up to very much, and then suddenly this opportunity comes along, and like you say, she rises above herself.
And as the series progresses, I guess she does so rather spectacularly, really. You know, that even puts a little bit more of on it. I thought A-level was a little higher than high school, so I guess there we go. Learn something new every day. Let's move on.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so the Christmas Invasion was following on from the regeneration of the Ninth Doctor into the Tenth. This episode introduced David Tennant in the role, in essence, and we still have Rose as the companion, of course, but once again, it's actually mostly told from Rose's point of view by virtue of the device of having David Tennant and the regeneration gone wrong, lying in bed for most of the time in her flat. I think it's a clever device, and it's similar to what they did when John Pertwee, when the Third Doctor was newly regenerated in Spearhead from Space. Because
but how many episodes can we count where they use that as, I hate to call it a gimmick, but that's what it sort of turned into. I mean, Eugene and I were discussing this not too long ago, and it's fine every once in a while, but when you keep going back to it, and after a while, as a viewer, I just think, oh, please, can we just let the Doctor get on with it?
Well, you know, there is one. I'll step in their defense on this one in one instance. This is, again, the first time they regenerated for the new group of viewers. I'll call them kids, new group of kids. And I guess we should let Simon finish off.
Yeah, no, the thing about it is that Doctor Who has this thing of regeneration, and every time a new actor plays the character, you're going to get a new take on that central role. So in some way you need to make the most of that. You need to introduce the new Doctor, and I kind of think having us all sitting there waiting, and then at the end having him step into the situation when it's got so bad that it's never going to get resolved unless the Doctor can actually pull it out, is a really clever way of doing it, because by then you're ready to cheer for almost anything he does. And you do, because he comes out waving his sword around, throwing tangerines all over the place and quoting Arthur Dent while he's walking around in his pyjamas, which I just thought was brilliant.
It was the first cheer-worthy moment in the new Doctor Who. I mean, it was a stand-up and like, yes! When he stood out there in his bathrobe, and that was...
But that's the payoff for having him in bed for the whole episode.
It is. But it's a long episode, too, isn't it? I mean, it's not just a typical 45 minutes. It's closer to 90, as I recall.
I forgot how long it was, but it was a pretty long episode.
It was about an hour.
It is consistent with a lot of the stuff that Russell T. Davies would talk about, in that he liked to deal with the family. And I think it's a topic that's not... This is my thought, actually. And it's actually written down here on paper, so I should have had no problem with it. That they deal with the family, and they deal with the impact of the people who are around the Doctor. And it's so many times when we've had the regeneration, if a companion has seen the regeneration, you know, they accept that it is the Doctor. It's weird, but they accept it. If they didn't see it, but they knew the Doctor, then they don't accept who the Doctor is. For example, the Brigadier not recognizing John Pertwee because he didn't see the regeneration occur. And in this case, we actually have a companion who really agonizes over this change. I mean, she's really feels betrayed to the Doctor, which I'm not sure I would agree with that emotion, but yeah, Rose can be irrational. So I'm not diminishing the fact that it's probably could very well be a legitimate reaction that somebody would have. So this is really where RTD gets into that kind of emotional background, and it's a different approach, and I'm glad they didn't do it over and over again, and I would have liked it to be a bit shorter, but you're right. There needed to be some upfront where she kind of deals with it, and then, and you know, by the fact that she can't talk to the Doctor, she can't really get a good feel that he really is the Doctor either. So, it was an interesting take on it, and overall, the episode, particularly when you get to the end with the sword fighting and the Satsuma, which is a word we do not use in the United States at all, to my knowledge, for tangerine, had to look that up, was, you know, David Tennant is the Doctor! At that point, I was overjoyed. That won me on that episode at that point. Just completely. I guess we can move on.
Yes.
Okay. So, Smith and Jones was the first episode in which Martha Jones appears, and once again we have the device of seeing the episode and the Doctor from Martha's viewpoint. I've got a bit less to say about this episode, because although it had its redeeming features, it didn't quite seem as original as some of the ones that had gone before. That device had been used before, and I don't know, the rain going upwards, the hospital on the moon, it all seemed a bit unnecessary, really.
My note is horrible plot hole story here on this one. I can remember all those things, like why move it to the moon? The explanation's not good enough. Why did the rain go up? It's not good enough. The story itself doesn't make any sense that I can see. You know, I mean, it's so full of holes. But what it is interesting for is that it's not just the first time the Doctor and Martha meet. But it is. It's the first time we ever see the Doctor essentially auditioning a companion. He's testing her. And we've never seen that before or since, as far as I can tell. And she rises to it. I mean, Martha is smart, you know, in comparison. She's very different from Rose. Not saying that Rose wasn't smart, but I mean, Martha is extremely perceptive and breath of fresh air. I really like Martha.
Yeah, she certainly was a departure from Rose. I thought that was an intelligent move on Russell's part to, you know, let's not get a Rose replacement, essentially. Let's get someone who's different. who thinks on a different level than Rose did. And yeah, that was, in fact, I would say that was probably the only redeeming element of the entire episode, is the fact that it now had Martha.
And the unredeeming piece is where he had to kiss her to transfer a little bit of DNA to delay the bad guys so that it would have something to put in the trailer reel. I think that's all it was for. Is it get a kiss, then we can put it in the trailer for the promos for the series to get people like, ooh, more kissing. Because they did that with Rose, too, if I'm not mistaken, in the earlier series, didn't they? No. That was later. Never mind. That was for when Cassandra took her over. So that was for this series, yeah. They were big on that kissy shots.
Yeah, or a category just for the kissing episodes.
Yes, I think we may move on at that point. So, Partners in Crime was the episode that reintroduced Donna, and of course, we already knew Donna because Donna had appeared in The Runaway Bride, but we were going to have her as the companion for this whole series. So, it served as the opening episode in which she's reunited with the Doctor, and I found the change in Donna's character a bit strange in this. It didn't seem consistent with the Donna that we'd seen before. She was smarter and more self-sufficient, and we were supposed to believe it was just because, I don't know, some of the Doctor's qualities had rubbed off on her. But she was spending her time going around investigating things and wishing that she had gone with the Doctor, when clearly when we last saw her she said she hadn't. And I guess that bugged me a bit. The episode itself wasn't good enough to shake off those concerns.
I hadn't really thought of that, but you're right. She is less annoying than she was in The Runaway Bride. I mean, she was a bit of a loser. I mean, really. I mean, it's, you know, like fooled by a guy who wants to marry her just to kill her, and this is terrible. But yeah, I did take that she was improved by that experience. And I think, don't we want every person who's ever come in contact with a doctor to be a better person when they leave the doctor's room? So I would take
that point. I can see that there, by the end of The Runaway Bride, she had begun to change, and I could see that. The thing that I guess I didn't like was that at the end of The Runaway Bride, she said, although she'd been changed and her life had been changed and she found the experience quite an eye-opener, she'd still made her decision that she wanted to stay at home. And then suddenly, when we find her again, she's actually spent all this time looking for the Doctor. And I found that a bit odd, and I thought maybe it would have made more sense to me if they'd actually had her somehow transported away in the TARDIS to save her from some peril, but not necessarily out of choice on her.
Out of choice. It's interesting that the actor who played her father had passed away. It's not interesting that the man passed away, but it's interesting that he passed away, and so they replaced him with her grandfather, Bernard Cribbins. And the character of Bernard Cribbins, Alf, right? Wilf. Wilf, that's right. That's not a name we know. Is a dreamer, a stargazer, someone that you know, wants to get out there. And so you could, if you had thought he was around the whole time, then you could kind of see how Donna might have had a little bit of this wistful streak. But there's no evidence of that, and I'm sure, of course, that there was no intention of A, her ever coming back, and B, you know, the thought of having a grandfather who was that way. So, yeah, a bit of a retcon. A bit of a retcon on Donna.
Perhaps. I would say that of all the episodes that fall into this category, this one was my absolute favorite. The reason I say that is, well, I happen to be an enormous fan of Catherine Tate. I think she's a marvelous actress, as demonstrated in later episodes, how she could really show a great range in terms of emoting. So, and the other thing I really liked about it is, while there was some level of introduction, it wasn't done to the degree as we'd have to have with previous episodes. So there wasn't so much of, I don't call it a waste of time, but a lot of energy spent towards that part of the storytelling. We didn't have to go down that far. Just a little bit to remind the audience who is Donna Noble, and then just pretty much go from there. And I happen to like that. And I love Donna Noble's or Catherine Tate's sense of comedy. And she really got to do some, I thought, was some marvelous comedic scenes with David Tennant.
But if you only you could see me, we don't have the video turned on, but if only you could see me, my mouth just dropped. I would never in a million years thought that was your favorite episode.
In this category it is.
In this
it's
category. And I... That blows me away, and second, I thought we were going to save it to the end, but okay. So you stunned me on two levels, but I was like, really?
No one expects me to pick that one as my favorite, but it is.
I have to say, I do not like Catherine Tate. I mean, I liked her fine as Donna, but I tried watching the Catherine Tate show several times, and you know, I am a huge fan of British comedy, but every once in a while, a show like Hello, and the Catherine Tate show, I can just sit there and for half an hour without cracking a smile. And I do not particularly like Catherine Tate, so I was shocked that I liked her as well as I did as Donna. And this film had really stupid fat monsters. And I don't mean the monsters were fat. I mean, they were fat, made of fat.
The monster was really cheap. I mean,
cute
about this episode was, yeah.
Did they ever sell those? Simon, did they ever sell those in the UK, like little action figures for the Adipays?
I would imagine. They seem to sell almost everything else. But I'm not a collector of these things.
I remember there was talk about that at the time. It's like, oh, that was obviously designed like the Ewoks to be a little a marketing to it. But then I don't recall ever hearing anybody selling them. So I...
Well, I actually did see on some special... I can't remember what, something from the UK where someone actually had one behind them. It was like on display on a shelf somewhere behind someone else, and I couldn't help but notice that. It was very predominantly placed.
All right, well let's move on to the next episode.
So the final episode in this category is The 11th Hour, which introduced both Matt Smith as the 11th Doctor and the character of Amy Pond. And this was unusual in being, well, although The Christmas Invasion was a longer episode, as we said, this was unusual in being a longer episode as an opener. And I think that really worked in its favour because it gave us a much sort of slower paced introduction to the 11th Doctor as he wanders into young Amy's house in the middle of the night and starts making fish custard, which still cracks me up. And... I won't mention the thing that he...
in her room?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I know you chaps get a bit excited about it.
No, never mind.
Don't do it. Whatever you do, I beg of you.
I saw last night's episode of the IT Crowd, so I have a new term for it now. But anyway, and this episode, unlike The Christmas Invasion... doesn't feel like it's longer to me. I would not have noticed that it was a long episode because of the pacing on this one. It fills the time correctly to me, and I think it also. Well, I'll go on and say that I'm not going to declare my winner in this category, but I really thought this episode was a cracker. I thought that the Doctor is having his regeneration trauma, which we talked about earlier, but he's not incapacitated. So he's challenged, and a hero challenged is a dramatic opportunity to rise even higher than he normally would. You know, under normal circumstances, the Doctor could just whip these guys, you know, with his sonic screwdriver tied behind his back and one eye closed. But in this episode, he's scrambled. He has no TARDIS. He has no sonic screwdriver. His brain's not working correctly. The post office is closed. And he's got a companion who's got some issues with him. Not necessarily for or against him quite as an adult yet, because she's still got her psychological problems about him abandoning her as a child. So I thought this is really an example where the Doctor rises up above all adversity and solves it, and I thought that really worked well in a regeneration episode.
One of the things that I did like this episode very, very much. One of the things that bothered me regarding Christmas Vacation, Christmas listen to me. Oh my God,
Chevy Chase classic film.
Chevy Chase, oh dear. But with Christmas Invasion is. Here we're introduced to basically a new Doctor, but we really don't get a sense of him until the very end of that episode, when he does come, you know, charging out, quoting Arthur Dent and wanting a cup of tea while wearing a bathrobe. So that did kind of set me off just a little bit, especially when we have a new Doctor. I want to get to know the Doctor, and the show is called Doctor Who. I want to get to know this Doctor as soon as I possibly can. So to have Matt Smith come in, and as Stephen Moffat had said in an earlier interview, he wanted his Doctor to hit the ground running, and Matt Smith's character did. Even though he was challenged, he was still something of a person of action, and we were, through comedy or action, whatever you want to call it, we were getting a sense of who this Doctor is going to be, and I found that enormously refreshing.
Well, contrast that to, ooh, we're breaking the pattern here, Castrovalva in the classic series. I mean, to me, that is the regeneration story to drag on forever. Because the Doctor's in the Zero cabinet, the Doctor's in the Zero room, we get little flashes of him. I mean, to me, I wouldn't say that's the worst regeneration episode, but it's the worst regeneration scenario.
It was pretty poor.
And Twin Dilemma is the worst regeneration story.
Well,
none of Time and the Ronnie.
Time and the Ronnie.
They're all bad at that point.
Go ahead. You can see the... I haven't seen all of these yet, and it's... One of my ambitions to make sure that I've seen every single regeneration episode. But one of the things it has taken from Castrovalva is that comparison with the previous Doctors, because in Castrovalva you've obviously got Davison doing his best Troughton impressions, etc., etc. Whereas in this you have that moment on the roof where all of the previous incarnations of the Doctor are projected by the whatever thing it is that's trying to catch Prisoner Zero.
Which was cool.
I liked
it. Well, no, it was very cool, but the timing was perfect, because all through that episode, you do have the Doctor struggling with the sense of who the hell is he, and then at that moment, it clicks, he gets who he is, and we get who he is. We realise that, yes, he is the Doctor. There is no doubt about it. His bow tie is on, he steps through the hologram, and the 11th Doctor has arrived.
Well, I think it was also a marvelous use of storytelling on Stephen Moffat's part, because there was a lot of skepticism about... I mean, David Tennant was enormously popular here in the States, and I think in the UK he was rated as the most popular actor to ever play the Doctor. I'd heard that. So there was some pretty mighty big shoes to fill on Matt Smith's part. So that scene was so well written, so well filmed, portrayed, all of that, so that when not just the Doctor accepts the mantle of being who he is, but it there's something very reaffirming in the viewer to be able to see that scene and say, you know what? He is the Doctor.
He is the Kwisatz Haderach.
He is the Kwisatz Haderach.
All right, well, then I guess we've come to the point where we have the reveal, except for Ben, who has
already blurted it out.
Revealed a little prematurely. Simon, do you want to go first, or do you want me to give you my take, or have we, from our discussion, is it fairly obvious?
I'm guessing that you're going to go for the 11th hour.
I am going to go for the 11th hour. I do think that was I do think that was the best of those episodes, simply because of the pacing and the challenge and the fight and it and even the slow charming scenes with young Amy Pond at the beginning. I loved that episode. I could not have thought of a better first episode for any Doctor than that one, actually.
I've got quite a lot of affection for the Christmas Invasion. Mm-hmm. I'm sorely tempted to pick it, but I do think that all those elements in the 11th Hour, and there's such a lot of it, and Stephen Moffat really does make the most of them, and there is that slow build up, there's that unpicking, there's the time differences that introduce you to Amy when she's young, and then she returns and she's been making all these dolls of the Raggedy Doctor, and all the time Matt Smith in as it were real time within the episode is just, I mean, obviously it wasn't the first episode he filmed, but he's just becoming the 11th Doctor, and I think it's brilliant.
I would say, even though I did voice my feelings on this subject, that from a filmmaking standpoint, I would probably agree with all of you that the 11th Hour is the stronger episode. It had two disadvantages, two challenges, and that is you're not just introducing a new companion, you're introducing a new Doctor at the same time. So there was a lot of hurdles that this story had to overcome. And in that respect, it succeeded much more strongly than Partners in Crime. Its challenge was far less.
Do you guys remember the film Batman? It's a minor film that came out a few years ago. And there's a sequence where Batman and the Joker are towards the end where Batman's saying, "You made me," and the Joker's saying, "You made me," and
yes,
they made each other. I kind of get that out of this episode. I mean, the Doctor, by accident, made Amy into his companion by arriving when she was a child, and she was the person who was with him to help form him and beat him with a head with a cricket bat. In this episode, they kind of evolved into the Doctor and the companion together. They're very interlinked in that story, and I thought that was a nice touch. We should, now having determined that Matt Smith wins 2 out of 3 for that category, let's move on to the celebrity historical.
Please join us again next time for part 2. You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback. Contact us at feedback@fusionpatrol.com or follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fusionpatrol. Our theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.